So I went to a bookstore recently, and I walked in and I asked the lady at the counter where the self-help section was. She told me if she told me it would defeat the purpose. All right, you guys are sitting too low. That went right over your head. That's funny. But have you guys been to a Barnes & Noble or a Books A Million recently? Like, have you seen the size of these self-help sections in these stores? They're humongous. They are absolutely enormous. And there's all of these books, and they're all somewhat different, but they're all the same. All these books have this weird obsession with pillars, with this idea of foundation, things to build your life on. And so we are all constantly looking for these pillars to build our life on that will make our life work. Everybody is looking for that secret, that one thing that if we make this change, our lives are going to work. So I heard a story when I was in college and was dumb of how Play-Doh came to be Play-Doh, you know, the colored, you know. That Play-Doh was originally this weird white goo that was designed to clean wallpaper from soot, from wood-burning stoves and heating. And the guy who had invented this goo was going out of business with gas and electric heating as it was becoming more popular. And so he was on the verge of bankruptcy, and so he had a sister. His sister was a preschool teacher, and she had found that her students liked playing with this white goo more than hard modeling clay. And so she recommended to this guy that he color it and call it Play-Doh. And the moral of the story, that as I heard it when I was in college, was that we are all one minor adjustment from making our lives work. And like I said, when I first heard that story, I was young and stupid, and I thought, you know what? That is true. I am one small change from bliss. And then I got a job, and I started to grow up a little bit, and I started looking around you. Like, think about the people you work with on a given basis. Do they seem like they are one small change from paradise? Like, the guys I work with are grumpy. Like, really, really grumpy. And so I thought maybe we're just in the wrong place. So I went on vacation about a month ago, and I went to the two places that my whole life, everyone in the world had been telling me that if you would go to these places, this is where people's lives worked. I went to Disneyland, and I went to Beverly Hills. Now, Disneyland, it was just people were hot and shocked at the amount of money they had spent. It was not quite what advertised. But I went to Beverly Hills and walked down Rodeo Drive, and I couldn't help but be let down. You know, if you watch TV, if you read magazines, they will tell you that, man, Rodeo Drive is where people go to be happy. But that's just not the case. So we went down there, and of course, if you walk down Rodeo Drive, you have to buy something. So we bought an $8 box of gummy pineapples. It was about that big, and it was $8, and I was shocked. But we also went down to People Watch, and I observed a couple things. I saw a man in a $9,000 suit arguing with his wife on the phone. I saw a girl who was wearing shoes that cost more than my rent, and she was complaining to her dad that she had had a friend who had betrayed her and spoken bad about her. And I thought to myself, man, this is not where people go to make their lives work. These people aren't even happier than I am. And so people are looking for these pillars, looking for these things in these self-help books that will make their lives work. And for so many people, it doesn't. And so we're going to spend some time. We're going to spend the next 4 weeks while you're with me. We're going to open the book of Colossians, and we're going to read this letter from a guy named Paul to this church in Colossae. And we're going to read just some of Paul's thoughts and ideas and theology. And I want you to get a good background of who this guy named Paul was. Paul, before he met Jesus, was the smartest, one of the most influential, absolutely brilliant guys that you could ever know. He was well-respected, made a good living. And after Paul met Jesus, he spent the rest of his life being imprisoned, homeless, poor, alone, beaten, imprisoned, and eventually killed. So Paul writes this letter. He is in prison as he's writing this letter. And he endures all kinds of these hardships. But in the midst of all these hardships, I guarantee if you were to ask Paul, Paul would say that his life worked, that his life was filled with peace and joy. That's one of the things that made Paul absolutely impossible to argue with. So for those of you who kind of come from a church background, kind of know Paul's story, you kind of get this idea that people would look at Paul and say, Paul, we're going to throw you in jail. And Paul would say, fine, I'm going to convert your guards. That, or, Paul, we're going to kill you. Cool, I get to be with Jesus. All right, Paul, we're going to let you live. All right, I'm going to keep preaching. Like, he was impossible to argue with. And if you asked him, his life was filled with peace and joy. And man, don't we want some of that? So Paul is going to show us in Colossians that we have these ideas, these pillars that we want to build on, pillars of a happy and healthy life. But for so many of us, as we look through the self-help section, we are choosing the wrong pillars. And the only pillars that we can truly build our life on is these pillars of the gospel. And so if you don't have a Bible, this is time to go ahead and grab Bibles. They're there at the end of your rows. We've got the page number over here. We're going to open to Colossians chapter 1, and we're going to read about these pillars of the gospel that Paul is pointing us to. So I want you to understand that every sermon, everything you read, every argument has a thesis. And Paul's thesis in this section is this, that Paul's life worked because he understood properly his priorities. He understood who Jesus was. And Paul's point is that Christ is central in all things, from his authority and his power and holiness. He reigns supreme over everything and is the image of the invisible God. But we are alienated and hostile in mind and are separated from God. And because of the cross, we are reconciled with our Creator. I'm going to break that down slowly, but that's the map of where we're going to be headed to. So open your Bibles, find Colossians 1. We're going to start reading. And start in verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. So I want to stop right there, and I want to start with, he is the image of the invisible God. Now I know I just stopped 7 words into a sermon that's going to cover 7 verses, and you guys are already ready for lunch. So I'm going to try to hurry through this. But I want you guys to understand that I listen to a lot of pastors as I do my prep work. And all of these pastors did an individual sermon just on those 7 words, and they were all an hour and a half. So I'm going to really, really, really have to hustle. But have you guys ever stayed up at night and wondered what God is like? Like, I do that, and those nights I don't sleep a ton, because God is such an abstract, invisible being that he is just mysterious and invisible, and he's difficult to grasp. But what Paul's going to tell us is that Jesus is the image of this invisible God, that Jesus reflects God the way that a mirror is your reflection. That if you want to know what God is like, you point to Jesus and follow that. So we spent a ton of time before the summer started going through the book of John, going through this story of Jesus' life. And I encourage you, whether you were here or not for that, go back and listen to some of those with this understanding that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. That Jesus' actions, Jesus' miracles, Jesus' authority, they are all God's actions and miracles and authority. And Jesus' words, as he teaches, are God's words. That Jesus is the tangible image of the spiritual God. Like, have you ever thought about how amazing that is? Just that we don't fully understand who Jesus is. Because if we did, we would be constantly falling on our face before him in worship. And so how does Paul come to this understanding? So I want to zoom out and give you a quick background as to who Paul is versus who Paul was. So Paul got his start, like I said, he was very intellectual, very well respected, but he was not a Christian. And more than that, he spent a lot of his early life committing terrorist acts against Christians. He would hunt them down, he would kill them, imprison them, and ultimately terrorize Christians. And that was his life. And so Paul was just chasing the church and harassing Christians, and the church feared him. But everything changed one day when Paul met Jesus. Paul saw the image of the invisible God. And Paul had this life-changing transformation process where in a split second, he saw the real Jesus. So when Paul is talking about Jesus being the image of the invisible God, it's not some abstract theological idea. Paul knows this information firsthand because Paul saw Jesus for who he is. And that interaction completely changed everything who Paul was. So Jesus appears to Paul, and Paul gets this understanding of who Jesus is. But I want to go back because I have to keep hustling. In verse 16, "For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him." So I don't know about you, I am kind of, at least, a nature guy. I love to spend time outside and see creation as long as it's not too hot or there are too many mosquitoes. I enjoy spending that time. So I was on vacation. We were in California last month, and there's a highway in California that goes between the coast in California, the ocean, and these huge bluffs. It's Highway 1, and as you drive it, if you look left, you will see nothing but the blues and the greens of this ocean. And you'll see the waves coming in and smashing against these bluffs. And it's beautiful. And if you look to the right, you'll see the bluffs and the hills and all the green of the trees and the orange of the rocks. And it's a beautiful experience and moment as you see the awe and beauty of creation. And for us, that, or at least for me, that experience sends me back to a awe and wonder of the God who is creator. That he creates colors and beautiful things and massive rocks and hills and snow-capped mountains and all of those things. That leads me back to this awe. But for us to understand rightly, we also have to understand that Jesus being the image of the invisible God means that Jesus was present and active in creation. Like I said, we spent a lot of time in the book of John and talking about that book and that letter. And the book of John begins with John, this friend of Jesus, saying that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he continues later that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That this idea that Jesus was there in the beginning, and he was active in creation, and that he created everything, and that nothing was created without him. And so for us, that should lead us to an awe of Jesus, this understand of power, of the person who created everything. Like, for Jesus to be creator is for us to understand that Jesus cannot bounce checks. Like, he is infinite in his authority and power and awesomeness. But it also leads us to understand that being owner of something does lead us to some authority and some ownership of that. So we have Christ who is the creator. That's our first pillar. And so if Christ is the creator, he was there at the beginning and present and active in creation, that also leads to ownership and authority. So here's an example. When I was young, and even now that I've gotten a little older, my dad had a phrase that he loved to say to me. And this phrase was, "I brought you into this world, I will take you out of it and make another one who looks just like you." And I wasn't really nervous about that until a couple years ago when I realized that he has four other kids who all look just like me. So if I go missing, start the investigation with him. But this idea stemmed from, and he was always joking, he was never, you know, never really serious about this, but this idea stemmed from that I created you, and with that comes a certain responsibility for my life as he directed it and got to make calls, and at a certain point, I answered to him. So when I got bad grades, I would answer to him, and then he would say, "I brought you into this world, I'll take you out, make another one look just like you." I mean, but this idea that being creator of something means that the created thing answers to the creator. Here's another example, if you guys kind of would understand this better. My wife loves to go to this store called Lush. It's in the mall. They sell soap and things that smell nice. I get dragged into that place on a monthly basis. I'm there all the time. And so while I'm there and I'm waiting patiently, one of the things I like to do is I like to read the labels because they're usually really funny. But one of the things I noticed is that if you look and you flip over whatever it is, on the bottom or somewhere on the back, they have a stamp. And on that stamp is a picture and a short bio of the person who made and packaged that product so that you can see who was involved in the making and packaging. But I want you to understand that we are that product, that we are made and we have the stamp and tag of the one who created us. That is a huge deal. That if Jesus is creator, then Jesus gets to make the final call as the ultimate authority. And so we are to give an account before Jesus as his possession. I want you to kind of go back, find Colossians again in verse 17, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. So he is before all things hold together. He is the firstborn of the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. Now, I want you to understand something. This word firstborn, this is one of the verses and one of the places that people like Jehovah's Witnesses will point to say that Christ is a created being, that he was the first creation, and that God is separate from him. One of the things to understand is when you talk about firstborn, especially in this instance, the word that they use in the original language more often means the first place of position, the top of the totem pole, the order of most importance, the highest priority. And that's where Jesus fits, that Jesus is this word, big word, preeminent, that he is first, he is most important. And in him, all things hold together. It's a really interesting idea that in him, all things hold together. And so we look at this second pillar of Christ, who is ruler over all. That he is in authority over all things, and in him all things hold together. So what that means is for you, as we are looking for how do we make our lives work, the answer is we live with Jesus as our highest priority in all things. And as we do that, those things will fall into place where they need to. And so we have people who look and they say, my marriage is struggling. I don't know how to make this work. You put Christ as the number one priority in your marriage, and then everything flows downhill from that. Or my job, or my finances. In him, all things hold together. That Jesus is preeminent over all things. And for you, if there is something that is just not working. If you're saying, man, I don't get any joy out of my work, my job is a struggle and it's hard, then ask yourself, Are we putting Christ as the head over that aspect of my life? Are we putting Christ over as the head over my marriage, my family, my kids, my finances? And so Christ rules over all things. And that is universally true whether we acknowledge it or not. C.S. Lewis, who was a great philosopher, once said, "A man can no more diminish God's glory by refusing to worship him than a lunatic can put out the sun by scribbling the word darkness on the walls of his cell." So Christ is ruler. That is not going to change regardless of where we put him in our lives. That Christ is the ruler whether we make him ruler of our lives or not. The problem is that so often we are the lunatic writing darkness over our windows and trying to blot out the sun, and then we're shocked when we can't see. And so for us, we are trying to usurp the authority of Christ. I want you to once again find Colossians. We're in verse 19. "For in him the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, to present you holy and blameless before reproach to him." So, for us in our lives, we do not see Christ as preeminent. Like I said, we don't see Christ for who he is so often. We have decided that we want that job. We want preeminence in our own lives. And so we want to run the show. We want to be the top of the totem pole, the first position. We have decided that we want to run our lives and that we don't want Christ to rule over us. And so that's led to us this position that we are sinners both by nature and by choice. So I come from a family of teachers. My grandparents were teachers. My mom's a teacher. My now wife is a teacher. If you are teachers out there, you understand this concept that we are sinners by nature. I got yelled at a lot when I was a kid because other kids were sinners by nature. So let me explain. My mom was an elementary school teacher, and she would go to work and have to deal with just the craziness of other children. She would get home to her children, and they were also sinners by nature, and she would be understandably impatient. And we would get in some trouble. And I remember thinking that someday I'm going to move out and I will never get yelled at because of someone else's kids ever again. And then I married a preschool teacher and hear all the stories of the biting and the spitting and the fighting and the crying and the cussing. And now I'm not sure how you people have so many children. Like, I don't understand this. That we come out on day one as sinners. And you who have two-year-olds, you know this. But then I also look at my life and at lives of people I know. And that I'm not any better. Like, do you ever lay in bed and take an honest look back at your day? I don't sleep well on those nights. I don't do well on Sundays when I think back to the week before and man, I should not have been impatient with that person. I should not have said what I did. I should not have thought that. Like, I don't know what goes on in your heads, but I know mine. Like, if people could read my thoughts, I would have no friends. Like, I go from stubborn and selfish and awful to self-righteous and judgmental, like, in a heartbeat, and that's on a good day. And if you're honest with yourself, like, take a minute right now and think about the past week, the conversations, the thoughts, the ideas that you have run through as you tried to run your life. Like, be honest with yourself that we are sinners by choice. This is what we want. And so it's easy for us to say, man, I'm messed up. I know you guys are messed up. We'll all be messed up together, and it's really not that big a deal. But for us to undervalue sin is a huge issue. So one of the guys that I listened to as I was preparing for this, he talked about sin in this way, that he called it cosmic treason. That we looked at our king and we said, I don't want you. I want to run my own kingdom. I am leaving you. I'm going to betray you, and I'm going to go play for the other team. And that we looked at that king, and in an ultimate act of defiance and betrayal, we decided that we were going to run our own show, we were going to live our own lives, and that we did not want his authority. That sin is a big deal as we look at the all-powerful, creating, holy God and decide that we want to betray him for a different kingdom. And so we are left understandably separated and alienated from God. And we are left in a situation where we keep trying to build our lives on these pillars of me, and it crumbles around us. So look back one last time here at Colossians, in chapter 19. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds. Now look at verse 22. He has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. So this last verse, that by his death we are presented as holy and blameless and above reproach. Later in October, we're going to talk a lot more about this guy. There's a guy named Martin Luther. If you don't know him, he's a Protestant reformer who is very well known in church history. But he called this idea of the great exchange. And here's the great exchange. That God is holy and all-powerful and nothing but good and perfect and wonderful. And we are sinners by nature and by choice. And we are alienated and hostile towards God. But that's a huge word, both in here and also in the book of Ephesians, another letter that Paul wrote. But Christ has reconciled us. This idea of paying a debt, of squaring a ledger, of paying a price. That Christ has not only taken our position, our place, that he lived the life that you and I should have lived and we didn't. And he died the death that we should die. And he gave a gift that we can't earn and paid a debt that he didn't owe. He didn't just take our place, that he also put us in his place. This idea of an exchange. So as we look at Christ, understand that he took your unrighteousness and he gave you his righteousness. He took your disobedience and gave you his perfect obedience. He took your evil and he gave you his holiness. He took your death and gave you his life. He took your treason and gave you his loyalty. He took your sin and he calls you his saint. That he took enemy and made them family. So part of the deal, and I didn't have nearly enough time to start at the beginning of this letter, that this letter is addressed to the saints of the Church of Colossae. Now, if you grew up Catholic, the word saint is probably going to weird you out. I'm going to be honest, I grew up Baptist, and it weirds me out because it weirds the Catholic people out. And so, if you grew up Catholic, this idea of being a saint was essentially like the Christian superheroes. That it was this idea. Or if you were Baptist, you just didn't talk about it because it weirded people out. But this idea that you are called a saint, follower of Jesus, you are called a saint. You can put that on your LinkedIn page, you know? I can type 40 words a minute, I can drive a stick shift, and I'm a saint. But follower of Jesus, he has taken your sin and called you his saint. He has taken your betrayal and brought you into his family. That it's not just that Christ is the creator and the ruler, but that he has reconciled you to himself. He has paid your debt. And so we're left with, if you are a follower of Jesus, look at your life. Look at what Jesus has done for us. And we need to understandably put Jesus in the place where he belongs. That Jesus is ruler over all, and we need to fall into repentance and obedience towards him. And that if you are not a follower of Jesus, you are still in this situation where you are hostile and alienated from God. And that Jesus rules over all, but he also has given you this gift of this exchange. And so as the band comes up, take stock. Like, we as Americans, we just celebrated the 4th of July. And Americans are built on this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How's that going for you all? How's that going for the people you work with? Like, going back to the Play-Doh, are you one small adjustment in building your life on yourself to making it work? Or are you in a situation where you need a complete rebuild of these pillars in your life? And so for us, we are going to understand who Christ is and where he belongs. That Jesus is of first importance, of first priority, and we are going to worship him. We are going to sing to him. We are going to pray to him. We are going to give to him. If you're a follower of Jesus, think about that as you leave here, of where is Christ ranking in your life? What are you building your life on? And reevaluate your lives so that Christ is where he is supposed to be. If you're not a follower of Jesus, we're going to have people up front kind of after the service. Take stock. Is what you're building your life on working? And if it's not, understanding that Jesus calls you, that Jesus says, come as you are, and that Jesus ultimately will take your place, put you in his, and will completely change you from the inside out. So we're going to worship Jesus, and we're going to leave here, and we're going to talk about Jesus, and we're going to continue to worship Jesus until we come back here next week, and we're going to talk about Jesus again. Because this is the idea of Colossians, that ultimately this sermon, these pillars, are what the entire book and the entire scripture is built on. Every word in the Bible is about Jesus and building up and worshiping Jesus. So let's pray, and then we're going to stand up and we are going to sing and celebrate and be at awe in the presence of Jesus. Jesus, we love you. We thank you that you are the creator and ruler of all things. We want to come to you and admit that we are evil and hostile and alienated from you so often. And we thank you that you have taken our place and given us your place. And we want to spend our time, our remaining time here, in worship of you and honor your name. Jesus, let everything we do this week bring honor and glory to you. In your name I pray. Amen.